All right, time to begin. For all of those expecting kin and a study in the divided kingdom, not going to happen this morning. They are still traveling back from helping his parents in Alabama. Things seem to have gone well there. A lot of work that they did trying to make preparations, so they're probably fairly worn out. They'll be traveling back today. And this evening, not sure if they'll be back tonight or not. And I know Ken leaves town again Tuesday, so I think he said we may not see him till next Sunday. I think he has to take a business trip Tuesday of this week. So certainly keep them in your prayers. I think things went well for him, and that certainly is encouraging to them as they make preparations to selling his parents' home, so they can make some better arrangements for them. Also, Judy's back. Glad to have her back safely. Thank you for all of those that were praying on her behalf, and thank you even more for all of those that were praying on my behalf. That was probably more necessary. Give everybody just a second to get settled, and we'll begin. We're going to actually be studying in Ecclesiastes, so if you want to turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 5, and did this for kind of a dual reason. One, leaving Ken's material to him rather than try and jump into that very late and teach the class. But then also, we've been in Ecclesiastes in our sermons on Sunday morning, and we're not going to be able to do that this morning, or we could have, but I chose not to do that. We've got a different lesson for this morning. And so I thought we'll just go ahead and take this slot to do Ecclesiastes and kind of pick up where we left off before in chapter 5. So as we begin, I'm going to ask Hal if he wouldn't mind to lead us in a word of prayer. Amen. All right, as I mentioned, we're picking up in chapter 5, and obviously Ecclesiastes, we kind of break where topics change, so the lessons are all pretty well self-contained anyway. We'll be picking up in chapter 5 and verse 10. The last verse we covered that section, verses 1 through 7, where we talked about reverence in worship as we approach God. Verses 8 and 9 deal with a topic that he'll pick up on again a little bit later, and so we're just going to kind of jump over that, where he talks about injustice and the oppression of the poor. And then chapter 5, the remaining part of it, and all of chapter 6 really deal with the same topic, which is kind of interesting. If I were just asked the question, it seems that he's been going in short little spurts about these different topics. And then all of a sudden, you get to the end of chapter 5 and all of chapter 6 pretty much dealing with one concept. What would be your guess as to the reason for that? Yeah, clearly the importance of it. The issue of it, the difficulty of understanding and applying the things that he talks about. And it's interesting because the topic that he has may very well be the single most talked about topic within the scriptures. I mean, excluding doctrinal topic, excluding the idea of all the historical things and things of that nature. But he clearly talks quite a bit, or God talks quite a bit in both the Old and the New Testament about the concept of what do we do with the things that we have, And how important are they to us as we talk about, at least this morning, wisdom about wealth? So what does God talk about? What is it that we're to do? How easy is it to be duped in this world into thinking that it doesn't have the influence on us that it has? That's the biggest key, I think, for us. In affluent society that we're in, living where we live, what do you think is the greatest challenge in all of that regarding this subject? Yeah, great point. I mean, to keep grounded, to keep the perspective, to keep a balance. Rob? That's right. Senior moment. I'm familiar with them. So, all right, well, let's pick up in verse 10. We're going to read down through the end of the chapter, chapter 5, because even though it's the same subject, when you get into chapter 6, there's a slightly different take on it that he has. But starting in verse 10, he who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much. But the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. There's a severe evil which I have seen under the sun, riches kept for their owner to his hurt. But those riches perish through misfortune. When he begets a son, there's nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, naked shall he return, to go as he came. And he shall take nothing from his labor, which he may carry away with his hand. And this also is a severe evil. Just exactly as he came, so shall he go. And what profit has he who has labored for the wind? All his days he also eats in darkness, and he has much sorrow and sickness and anger. Here's what I've seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life which God gives him, for it is his heritage. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. He will not dwell unduly on the days of his life because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. All right, so as you're reading through here and he starts talking about these things, it's interesting because he's going to address several issues that go along with the idea of the vanity of riches. So what things do you notice in here, kinds of things does he talk about? Where does he start? The vanity of riches, first off, is what? And we're in Ecclesiastes chapter 5. All right, he said, and the love of that is certainly vanity, but why? Vanity means what? We've talked about that before. What does Solomon mean when he says vanity? Yeah, Dave? I'm sorry, what?
Emptiness.
Yeah, there's an emptiness to it. It's like you ever had somebody play a prank on you and wrap a gift that didn't have anything inside of it? You know, and the excitement of having a gift there and you unwrap the box and everything else and there's nothing inside. Incredible disappointment. You thought it was going to provide joy, but it didn't. There's an emptiness and vanity. And he says, what about money is vain that way or is empty that way or without value or use? Rob? Yeah, great point. As we think about what it does for us, rarely, if ever, will wealth provide a natural inclination toward dependence. You have to fight for dependence on God, the wealthier you are. And he talks about that. That's why he says things like, you know what, if you've got a lot, you're just going to find it difficult because it provides its own problems. It doesn't mean it has to be a problem. There were people in the scriptures that were greatly wealthy, that were great servants of God. But it isn't without effort that happens. And so he says here, he starts off by saying the biggest vain thing is what? Much like that empty gift, he says what? He says it's not going to satisfy you. Rarely will you find somebody who is striving to get to a point financially, who achieves that point, who says, that's all I wanted to get to, I'm perfectly satisfied, I'm good the rest of my life. There's always a tendency, isn't there? As you strive for the new belongings, whatever they may be. You know, you wanted, you've worked hard, you've always dreamt about that new car, and what you're going to find out is probably what? It breaks down like any other car. And so it's going to have to be replaced anyway. What other things might you learn from that process? You ever think it's the, I'm sorry, what? Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It is, in fact, what pushes the desire, isn't it? The desire pushes desire. David? And it's not because you see one that's less attractive than the one you got. There's something about the new one that makes you want it too, isn't there? That, you know what, that's got some feature. That's got something that I would like to have, you know, that kind of thing. He's saying, you're going to find out. You think it's going to satisfy. He says, first off, it's vanity because it doesn't satisfy. Why is it helpful to know that on the front end? What's the advantage of front end knowledge? What's that? You know how to base your priorities. You're going to put things in a proper perspective. Great point. You know, I think in terms of like these couples that are getting married. Well, not this couple back there. It's a brother and a sister. But but his wife-to-be is probably around the premises somewhere. But also, you know, Nathan and Caitlin and stuff. And whenever we do premarital counseling with couples, one of the things we talk about is understand there's going to be contention. It helps to know on the front end that it's not going to go absolutely wonderfully every day for the rest of your life, that there will be contention. If you know that on the front end, you're better equipped to deal with that as you put priorities in place. With kids, we understand that, don't we? If you thought that your kids weren't going to make mistakes, how hard would it be to live? You know, but if you understand, that doesn't mean you accept them, but if you understand they're going to, then you deal with that. And he says, understand, it's not going to satisfy. Get that on the front end. The better you can grasp that, the better you are. Secondly, he says they're perishable. Like Hal says, that car's going to deteriorate anyway. It doesn't matter how gorgeous it is. If you use it, he said, it's going to deteriorate. It's going to fall apart. Everything's going to be of no value at some point. Isn't that what he's saying? And if you understand that, we talk about this in some of the marriage classes we do, some of the seminars and such. Women love flowers. Men are kind of take it or leave it on flowers. On an anniversary, most men are not hoping their wife will bring them home a vase full of flowers. You know, maybe a new cordless drill or something would be a great thing. And one of the points we make is men don't like flowers. Why? They die. Men think, you got to be kidding me. I'm going to spend $40 or $50 on a vase full of flowers. And I understand that's probably a pretty conservative estimate these days. But I'm going to spend that on a vase full of flowers. And they're going to be dead in 2 weeks. I don't understand the reasoning behind that. They're perishable. And we understand that. So we're less likely to be enthralled about that. He says, understand that about everything. You know, think in terms of everything falling by the wayside. I remember hearing a story because he says, you know, there's just no real value. But a guy who was in this particular story, not true, obviously, but a guy who was in kind of a conversation regarding his going to heaven later, and he's in a conversation with one of the angels, and he asked for just one thing. If he could just bring, and he had some gold bars, if he could just bring that box of gold bars with him, then, you know, he would greatly appreciate that. And so the angel told him, yeah, you can bring that with you, but here's your task. You have to carry them with you every day the rest of your life. And so he does. He drags those things around everywhere he goes for the rest of his life. He gets to the gates of heaven, and as the story would go, Peter's there to greet him. And Peter says, what's in the box? And so he opens up the box, and Peter says, oh, pavers. I mean, what really is the value of things compared to the spiritual side and the heavenly side? And that's what God is talking about. He says, understand, they're perishable. You're not going to have anything left in all of this. He says, they perish through what ways? How does wealth go away from you? What's that? Oh, okay, there you go. I'm sorry. Rob's losing his memory. I'm losing my hearing. You consume them. Yeah, absolutely. He says you're going to use them up, and so the wealth goes away. But it's interesting because he kind of talks about that a little bit later. Other ways, what does he say? People steal. He says there's misfortune. You know what? I mean, there's not many people breaking into the poor man's house. You know, there's not much to take. But he says, you know, the richer you are, the more security you feel like you have to have around your place. Why? Because somebody may steal. There's misfortune. Misfortune in the sense of, think about the people who have incredible wealth whose lives were turned upside down when you have something like a big recession and the stock market plummets. I mean, there could be misfortune financially that way that costs people loads of money. And so he says, you know, you've got misfortune. People can use it, take it away from you. He says it leaves the owner. You're not going to have anything left. Understand that. He says that's a part of it. Then he's going to talk about the proper use of riches. In chapter 5, he says, so here's a couple of the dangers. He says they don't satisfy, they're not going to last. How important is that to understand? They're not going to last. Now, is he saying, therefore, don't take care of what God gives you? Well, no, that's not what he's saying. He's not saying, you know, we have a home that God has made it fortunate for us to own. We understand. All that we have is a gift of God. But he doesn't say, therefore, as a Christian, you know, be unwise and destroy the very things that you have by way of gift. Treat them properly, you know, try to take care of the things and appreciate the gifts because they're not just for you. Why does he even give you what he gives you? Remember in Ephesians 4, he said, let him who stole steal no longer, but rather what? Anybody remember? Let him work with his hands, he says. But then he tells you why. Why? Why shouldn't you be a thief? Why should you work hard so that you can have money? What's he say in Ephesians 4? Anybody remember? Somebody turn there. Ephesians chapter 4, I think that's around verse 27, something like that. Who's there? Larry, you're there? Go ahead and read that. Okay.
Therefore, having put away falsehood, let each one of you speak the truth with his neighbor, for we are members one of another. Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger, and give no opportunity to the devil. Let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor doing honest work with his own hands, so that he may have something to share with anyone.
And there you go. Why do you have anything that you have by way of gift or wealth from God? Just so you can enjoy it by yourself? He never intended that. God has blessed us. And in this country, when we talk about things like some of the preachers that are in other places, the preachers that we support in India, where you've got multiple preachers, and now preachers that are going into China, and preachers that are going into Colombia, South America, and people that are going into Ethiopia, as we're helping those people, or we're helping others, he's saying, what's the benefit of living in the United States of America and being the affluent society that we are? What's the real benefit there? Helping others. He said that's the real benefit. That's what we need to understand. It isn't just the comfort that we have. He says we need to be helping others. And why? Because they're not lasting anyway. You may as well, you know, I tell my children that all the time. That's why we're spending your inheritance. It's not going to last anyway. But he does talk about the idea that it's perishable, and understand that. You build up incredible amounts of wealth, and it just keeps building, he said. And so what have you gained? All right. So he talks about the proper use. What's the proper use? We just talked about, obviously, sharing. But what's the proper use according to chapter 5, starting in about verse 18 through 20? All right. So he says, start there. The proper use of riches, he says, enjoy them as a gift from God. They're a gift. So what's the difference for you in something that is a gift versus something that you have earned? How do you view that differently? Yeah, so what we feel about it changes. There's a pride associated sometimes with what we feel we have done. There's a farmer that was talking to a preacher on one occasion and said, you know, he was talking about his farm. The preacher was over. He says, man, he says, incredible place. He says, love the way it looks, and, you know, all the crops you've got, the beautiful structures you've got and everything. And the guy said, let me tell you how this came about. And he talked about all the things that he had done, all the work he had put in, all the effort, all the labor. And the preacher says, you neglected, you know, to mention that all of this is a gift from God. This isn't all you. To which the farmer acknowledged. He said, you know what, you're right. He says, it is a gift from God. He says, but you should have seen it when God had it all by himself. So I appreciate the gift, but it's still me. Yeah, there's a pride associated with that. Other things, when it's a gift versus when it's something you've earned. Yeah, great point. If I understand the only reason I have it is because it was given to me, how much do I appreciate that? You know, again, even though it's not a material wealth issue, it's interesting that when we talk about marriage relationships, that God tries to impress on man the nature of the fact that his wife is a gift from God. She's the one that I gave you. How much should we appreciate because of the nature of it being a gift? So it does change our appreciation, doesn't it? Any other things? Yeah, Rob? Yeah, great point. What it is we view, if you just gave it to me, if I understand, I think that affects the concept of contribution as well. If I understand everything is a gift, how can I not be cheerful and willing to give back everything what I can, to be very generous in that? We kind of miss that point, but we start looking at it as ours, and that makes a difference as far as generosity as well. So he says, appreciate that as a gift from God, because it will change your attitudes about it. He says, but then understand this too. He says, not only enjoy it as a gift. So he says, when you're sitting down at that meal, you enjoy that meal. God says you should enjoy that. That's a gift from God. When we give thanks at the table, do we not thank him for providing the food? So if you thank him for providing your food, shouldn't you enjoy the food he provided? Yeah, I mean, it's just, he's saying, That in fact is why God gives us what he gives us. He wants us to enjoy it. He wants us to share it. He wants us to have the right perspective. But he blesses us with things with the intent of that we enjoy them. But then he comes back after that and says, understand the ability to enjoy them is a gift from God. What do you think he means by that? He says, not just enjoy them as a gift. Your ability to enjoy them is a gift from God. Yeah, no question about that. God can certainly take it away from us. He had just pointed out before, you're naked when you came into this world. You're naked when you're going back out of this world. Job, you remember, said, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. He had incredible wealth and lost every bit of it. His viewpoint was wrong as far as how it departed from him. But he understood that every bit of it can leave. Other things that means to you when he says that your ability to receive it. He says, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor. This is a gift of God.
I mean, every day that we had given us as a gift from God, we could be gone tomorrow. So, in that perspective.
Yeah, great point. And so, because he draws a conclusion immediately after that, doesn't he, in verse 20. He says, this is a gift from God. Receive it as a gift from God. For, remember we've talked about, always look for those words that attach. He says, it is an ability to enjoy, for, he says, he'll not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy. He says, you know what? You're not going to fret so much about tomorrow if what? You enjoy today. Focus on what God has given you. Remember the psalmist saying things like, this is the day that the Lord has made what? I will rejoice and be glad in it. I have today. He says, when you appreciate gifts that way, when you appreciate life that way, when you appreciate your possessions that way, he says, you're not consumed with the concerns and the worries about tomorrow. And Jesus, remember Jesus himself telling us, he says, you need to just focus on today because, he said, today has enough problems that you don't need tomorrow's problems in addition to today's. Yeah, Cheryl. Yeah, absolutely. Great point. You know, even when you watch those littlest of kids just get excited and just get happy and just smile and the noises they make. I mean, enjoyment. God has given us the ability to enjoy life early on. He says, you know what? There's just issues. Think in terms of, he said, you got lots of wealth. If you don't have the right understanding of it, he says you start losing sleep over it. He says, you can't even sleep well. He says, the guy that labors and that's all he does is labor, he says, he sleeps well. The guy that's loaded doesn't sleep so well. He's worried about the stock market. He's worried about the security. He's worried about everything else. He said, focus on what God has given you. And then in chapter 6, he's going to take us a slightly different direction. He's going to go from the vanity of riches, and he's going to start talking about some sad situations that are involved regarding this idea. He says, there is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it's common among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor so that he lacks nothing for himself of all he desires, yet God does not give him power to eat of it, but a foreigner consumes it. This is vanity. It's an evil affliction. If a man begets 100 children and lives many years so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with goodness or indeed he has no burial. I say that a stillborn child is better than he, for it comes in vanity and departs in darkness, and its name is covered with darkness. Though it has not seen the sun or known anything, this has more rest than that man. Even if he lives 1,000 years twice, but has not seen goodness, do not all go to one place? All the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet the soul is not satisfied. And what more has the wise man than the fool? What does the poor man have who knows how to walk before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of desire. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Whatever one is, he has been named already. For it is known that he is man, and he cannot contend with him who is mightier than he. Since there are many things that increase vanity, how is man the better? For who knows what is good for man in life, all the days of his vain life which he passes like a shadow? Who can tell a man what will happen after him under the sun? It's like, wow, that's a lot that he says in chapter 6. But he's talking about some sad situations. And he says, at first, he says there's a common affliction among men, which is what? He says, you know what, I've seen this evil under the sun. And I like that description. I've seen this evil. Have you seen any evil under the sun? In this world. Remember that under the sun is this horizontal view. He says, I've seen an evil. What does that mean to you, an evil under the sun?
Something that seems unjust.
Yeah, something that just isn't right. It's unjust. We've seen that kind of thing. In the justice system and the way people treat others and the way many things happen. I mean, we say, you know what? That, we say something like what? That is just wrong, don't we? We don't mean only just that it's a sinful behavior. It just shouldn't even happen that way. Have you ever said that? That's just wrong. He says, I've seen that evil under the sun. And he says, what is that evil, this affliction that exists, and who does it exist amongst? Because he's dealing with the same thoughts as he was in the last chapter. He's just taking them in a different direction. He says, so let's just kind of look at this world then. Yeah, Rob?
It's the idea that for a lot of mankind, if I could just what they have for the threescore tenants, so there's nothing off the deck.
Yeah.
And how he talks about a stillborn, you know, rather than a hundred children, he may look as living, even live, if there's no life.
Yeah, great. So the class of people he's talking about are the ones that are not following God here, right? Because he says, you know what? He says, God has given him an incredible amount of things. So do all of us fit that description, you think? Yeah, the answer to that is absolutely yes. You live in this country, period, probably. You need to answer yes to that question. We've been blessed with wealth, and we've talked about that before. I mean, when you think in terms of, you think of the wealthiest people in your mind. Give me a name. Bill Gates. He's one of the ones that always comes to mind, isn't it? You think of Bill Gates and the billions of dollars and such that he's worth. You realize in this country, you're not in the same class as Bill Gates financially. I'm guessing you're not. If you are, I'd like to talk to you more after services. You're not in that same class. But you realize as far as the world is concerned, you are. I mean, we are in like the top 3% of wealth in the entire world. I'm saying us in this room, not Gates. Gates is in the top quarter of 1% in the whole world. But I'm saying we're in like the top 3% in the entire world just because we have a home and we have a car and we have money in the bank, money in our pocket. That just those things put you in that class. He says, we've got the wealth. He says, but if you're not living right with it, he says, it's just an affliction. He says, you're not going anywhere with it. It's not going to help you in the long run. He said, so you got this man and he thinks in terms of, you know what, even if he has 100 kids, even if he lives 1,000 years twice, he says, he's afflicted with this because his life has not prioritized properly. It's just all done. That's all there is like Rob is saying. That's all there is in his life is what he has here. God has to be the primary focus. He says, and it doesn't make any difference. Even if you've got all these children, you got the long life, he said it's not going to make any difference. He's not saying there's no enjoyment in having the children. There's no enjoyment in having extra years of life. But when it's all done, give me a picture of what you view that man's dying days or hours to be like. What's your thought process?
I think
he's alone. There's an aloneness, no question. Sure. Yeah, no question. I mean, and there's no real joy even on the deathbed. For a Christian, I'm not saying that that makes death easy, but there ought to be joy as we approach the end of this life, shouldn't there? You know, I view that person as what can he think other than, this is it. It's done. It's over. Like Cheryl's saying, I don't know what they're going to do with it. He talks about that later. He says, you know what? You have no idea what's happening when you die. Whether everything you've ever worked hard for, every bit of it will be wasted. Solomon certainly was kind of telling his own future, wasn't he? You know, when he talks about you may leave it all to a fool, Solomon left it to a fool. Would you agree with that? You know, he took and immediately divided the kingdom of God because of his foolish actions. And so he says, you don't have any idea. You can work hard and it just goes. If it's not centered around God, he says, then it's incredible vanity. It doesn't matter how long you live. Doesn't matter what you have by way of children. So he has some kind of reflections at the end. He says, you can consume them. When you go home today, whether it's just typical Sunday or you've done something special because at least in our country and much of the world, this is viewed kind of, I mean, as a holiday, obviously. So maybe you have a bigger meal or something today. Do you expect to be satisfied when you leave the table? I'm usually not satisfied about when I leave the table. I'd probably be satisfied about if I left it earlier, but I'm always satisfied when you leave. I mean, have you ever just felt that way, and you sit back and you take that kind of deep breath, and it's like, wow, that was such a good meal. I feel so good. I mean, there's just a complete satisfaction. He says, money, you can consume it, but it doesn't do that for you. He says, not for the soul. There's nothing about money, though you use it and you accomplish whatever you want to accomplish and labor hard and work for all those things. He said, there's nothing about it that satisfies the soul. You know what? I have really accomplished something for God. I really feel good eternally about what I have done. Now, he says, you can use your money in such a fashion as to accomplish that. But it has to be with a focus on God. He says, otherwise, the soul's not satisfied. He's not saying the life can't be satisfied. I know people who have got great riches that are extremely satisfied with life here, but it's not the same. He says there's nothing that causes them to think in terms of eternal. And he says they can't change. I don't care how much money you have. It cannot change what's happening in life. You can't stop what's happening in this world because of the money you have. That's what he says. You can't change what's going to happen in the next generation. I don't care how many billions of dollars Bill Gates leaves to whomever he leaves it, or even while he's alive. And it doesn't matter what kind of philanthropist he is, and it doesn't matter where he diverts his money. There will always be hatred. There will always be wars. There will always be destruction in this world because there is sin in this world. And he's saying, I'm telling you, you can't change the vanity of life if all you're looking at is under the sun. So here's the key then. For the last couple minutes. So how do we accomplish what we need to accomplish regarding our attitudes and our approach to this particular subject? I mean, there's one thing to say. You know, it's always one of the things we talk about, pride. Have you ever met somebody that just opens up and lets you know, I'm an extremely prideful person, or do most people not acknowledge that? I mean, have you ever met somebody with pride that doesn't think they have pride, that suffers? You know, it's not the kind of thing that we acknowledge easily, is it? What about materialistic views? Easy to acknowledge that I'm tied to my possessions more than I should be? Or do we seem to feel that we're okay with what we have? And you understand what I'm saying? We're living in a world that is so affluent, I think we have lost touch sometimes of, is it influencing us more than it should be influencing us? And so how do we keep it from doing that? On practical levels, help me understand. That's great that we read what Solomon says and we say, amen, Solomon. You know what? I understand that. Riches will not satisfy They're just not going to do what I think that they're going to do. They're going to get lost in the shuffle. I can't control them afterwards. So what do I do about it? What do you do about it? Yeah, Ken? That has to be key. I have to be thankful and focused on the source of my blessings, I think, every single day. That I need to give God thanks that it is a gift and everything that I have is a gift. He talks about the same thing, even regarding things like we said, your spouse and your children, family. Those are all gifts from God and being thankful every single day. And then on top of that, everything else that we have. Recognize the source. And not just recognize it, address that issue every day, being thankful. If not, what happens? Start taking things for granted. And it doesn't matter whether now you're talking about people or possessions, does it? You don't appreciate them every day, you're going to have a tendency to slide the wrong direction. Nobody drifts upstream, spiritually or otherwise. Rob? I mean, think in terms of, you know, praying, God, all I need from you is my daily bread. All right? So you go home today, and there's nothing in your cabinets or your fridge, with the exception of just enough to have your lunch today. Not an easy thing to take, is it? I mean, we don't think in those terms. We like opening the fridge and seeing a multitude of things. What are ways that we can overcome the materialistic influence in our life? Recognizing and having the right approach toward understanding that I need to maybe pray about that and even asking God to help me keep that in check. We've studied some on some Saturday mornings, and those will get kicking back up again here shortly once we get past the wedding season. The breakfast studies we've talked about, we've been studying out of Richard Foster's book, Celebration of Discipline. His lesson on simplicity may be one of the hardest lessons I've ever tried to make application of. Not that difficult to read, but hard to make application of. The whole idea is give some stuff away. Make decisions like, I'm not buying anything new this entire year. You think that would be hard? You think about that. I'm not going to buy anything new. No new clothes, you know, unless something breaks and it has to be replaced. No new clothes, not buying a new vehicle, not buying any new tools, not buying anything new this year. And I'm going to take that money instead and give it to somebody or something cause that could use that. Think that wouldn't be a hard commitment to make? I'm going to go home and I'm going to give away half of my clothes. Think that'd be hard? So... You know, just there are ways that we can combat. We just don't like the ways to combat. And I'm not saying you have to practice those things. But you do need to look. I need to look at how do I make sure that it is not winning the battle in my life. Because Solomon says, I'm telling you, it'll never take you where you want to go. You better make sure you're dealing with it properly. Thanks for your attention this morning.